This episode, I am joined once again by Steve Knepper to discuss the work of Gabriel Marcel, alongside discussions on embodiment and being. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you'd like to support the podcast, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Steve Knepper, thanks once again for joining us on Emetics Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, James.
So we are going to be discussing the philosopher, theologian, and thinker, very broad thinker, Gabriel Marcel. And really, I'll open this up with stating that you think the best way to actually open this conversation is to reintroduce the hermeneutics question, because this is almost something that seems to have sort of consistently, naturally happened in Marcel's life, and a way to introduce him and, you know, the kind of thinker he was, before getting into the weeds of his philosophy and his thought and his life. So why do you think it is that the hermeneutics question, three thinkers in a room, living or dead, sort of helps introduce us to this character Marcel?
So Marcel, a French thinker, lives most of his life in Paris, and a huge part of his life, and this spills over into both his philosophy and his playwriting, was dialogue and conversation and debate. On Friday evenings, both before the Second World War and after, he would host Friday evening salons, and these would just be open. So a lot of times, students in Paris would come to talk to Marcel, but there would be actors there. There would be clergy after he became, he's a convert to Catholicism. And there would be a lot of the big names of French philosophy at one point or another are there in Marcel's salon. So Emmanuel Levinas says that he meets Jean-Paul Sartre there for the first time. Jacques Maritain and his wife are there. Lev Shestov, Berdyaev. So there are all of these thinkers. Jean Val, who's basically his lifelong friend, and you had an episode with him with my buddy Chris Hackett. Mm-hmm. So that might be another one. If you're interested in Marcel, you might go back and listen to that Val episode. Mm-hmm. So all of these thinkers were coming together in Marcel's apartment and having these conversations, having these debates. And so that was a big part of what makes him such an important figure, is he put people in contact with each other at those salons. He helped introduce thinkers like Kierkegaard and Nietzsche and Heidegger more into the French scene than they had been known before. So these are very important events in French intellectual history. And Marcel has a huge influence on other thinkers, in part through this and just part because he's a person of dialogue. Another interesting way to answer the hermeneutics question would be that we could also tag along you and me with Marcel and Emile Choron, who was one of his neighbors, and they would go on these long walks. They would go to the theater together for many years. So that could be pretty fun too. In a way, temperamentally pretty different thinkers, mm-hmm. but they had a great friendship.
I didn't know about that friendship.
Yep.
Choron seems to have been very amicable and friendly with most people, though, I think. I've never really heard a bad word said about him, in a way, considering his doesn't seem to actually have been miserable to be around. So these debates, these salons that were going on, was there a purpose? Was there where did these come from? You know, were they strictly theological, strictly philosophical?
Yeah, so I think Marcel wouldn't want to be thought of as a theologian, even though sort of the question of the divine and religious experience is at the heart of what he's up to. Mm-hmm. But he also was always, even after he converted to Catholicism, which he did so at a pretty late age, at the age of 40, he insisted that the main sort of through lines of his project were already established at that time. And he always said he wanted to write kind of in the doorway of the church so that he can speak to both Christians and believers of other religions, skeptics, agnostics. So that was very important to him. He would not have denied that even before his conversion, that his thought was fertilized by Christianity. He said that was basically unavoidable for European thinkers. Mm-hmm. But he he maintained a pretty strict division between what he thought was theology and what he thought was philosophy. So coming back to your question, which is what they talked about at these salons. So one of the reasons why I think that these were mostly for younger sort of students and up and comers is that Marcel, it sounds like, kind of tended to set the agenda. So it might be whatever he was reading or thinking about, he might launch on a little discourse and then sort of open it up to conversation. So Marcel really didn't have an academic career. He, you know, taught now and again. He was mostly an editor and wrote play reviews. Those were his main jobs. But I think that a lot of students in France kind of got a Marcel class at these Friday evening salons. And they sought him. They sought them out. They sought him out.
Okay. Okay. So it's more of an intellectual figure than a than an academic. So this, I mean, as I guess it's going to be a, you know, his my mistake to call him a theologian there at the start, but as his work is dealing with both sides of the coin, even though he's not a theologian. I guess I want to emphasize biographically this conversion to Catholicism, which you say, you know, happened when he was 40, which was quite late, but certainly in the air in the academic scene at that time, the importance of Catholicism and, you know, I guess Catholic philosophy as well. But you say he also wouldn't really, there wasn't some drastic change in his philosophy. The foundation was already there. So, you know, reading his work now, do you see a split? Do you see that event as being sort of a split, or just does, you know, and I guess also the other biographical question is why did he convert? You know, what was his reasoning?
Yeah, so these are great questions. First of all, I don't think you should apologize for calling him a theologian. One of the things that's interesting about Marcel is that he tends to bristle at labels. He didn't want to be a systematic thinker. He didn't want to be pinned down. He always thought of himself as a philosopher on the move in the midst of a journey. So probably the most famous label associated with Marcel is existentialist. Mm-hmm. He apparently introduced that word into French. And for a little bit, he was okay with thinking of himself as an existentialist. But eventually he rejected that. He didn't want to be associated with Sartre's existentialism, which he thought had come to sort of monopolize the term. So he was one that would at times allow a label, but I don't think he ever felt comfortable with a label and intended to reject them. And I think he always felt a little bit of a testy relationship with the Catholic intellectual scene, even though he was a big part of it and had many friends within it. He didn't become a Thomist. I think that he was probably dismissive of even the common ground that's there between his work and sort of a neo-Thomist like Maritain. You know, in the Christian thought at that, the Catholic thought at that time, mystery is a big word for Marcel, and we'll come to his particular definition of it. But there was a lot of discomfort among sort of a more traditional Catholic philosophy of using the term mystery for anything except the revealed mysteries mm-hmm. of religion. So he would get in sort of quarrels about that as well. So he's definitely a Catholic thinker, and I do think you can see its imprint on him. I think, too, I mean, he reads a lot of saints and spiritual writing. If you're interested in his conversion, the book to go to is this philosophical journal. He wrote a couple of them in his life that's published as a book, Being and Having, which over the course of it, you can see a lot of reflections on this conversion process. But I think because he's so interested in experience, it's that sort of spiritual writing that appeals to him and where he finds resonances with his own thought, his own experience, and probably finds resources to draw upon more than like Thomist manuals or something like that. So I think that's part of it. So his conversion's kind of interesting. At one point, the prominent French novelist Mauriac writes him a letter in response to a review of one of his novels. And he says, basically, Marcel, you're always talking about love and forgiveness and basically opening yourself to the other. It sounds like you're already a Christian. Why don't you take a look at the church? And he did and ended up converting. So that's why I think he saw it as a natural progression.
Yeah.
Certainly, too, he always had, he had an openness to religion from a very young age. He felt like that was something missing in his childhood. A formative event is that his mom dies when he's 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll circle back around that too, because I think that's very important to his later thought.
That's what I was going to ask. He wasn't a practicing, was he a practicing anything before Catholic?
Nope.
Just and open to it.
Just open to it. So his dad is a kind of a civil servant. He works as an ambassador. At one point, he's an ambassador to Sweden, and Marcel spent some time there, and that's important too. But his dad is very into culture. You know, Marcel learns a lot about drama and music from his dad, and those things are absolutely important to Marcel. But his dad is also an agnostic, grew up Catholic, but very dismissive of Catholicism as anything other than an aesthetic, right? Very grateful for the influence of Catholicism on art, music, but not really a believer of any sort. Mm-hmm. And his dad ends up marrying his aunt after his mom dies. So he marries his mother's sister, and she is very kind of morally committed, very ethical. And he responds to that too, but she too is not a believer. Her family is loosely Jewish. Mm. So Marcel takes something important from both of them, and they're very, very attentive parents, almost smothering. They put a lot of pressure on him. They recognize he has this tremendous talent, and they're always pushing him, pushing him, pushing him. And that's tough on him, but he also realizes that it comes out of a place of love and care and attention to him. And he takes that ethics from his aunt. He takes that cultural sense from his dad, but he always feels like there's something important that's missing. And I think it is tied up into the death of his mom and this sense that she's still kind of a present guiding force in his life. And he sort of feels like there has to be more to something to the world, in part because of that.
Okay. Something more to the world. And I guess to begin with his work, as you said, he has this deep interest in experience and the philosophy of existentialism. I mean, why are we here? What does it mean to be human? What is the meaning of it all for us human beings? Certainly has its ties with experience. So is there a central question which we could say plagued Marcel to the point where we can revolve the specifically philosophical discussion around it? It seems to be one of being, you know, the question of, okay, well, what is it to actually be?
Yeah, so I think I might approach that through another event in his life that I think is very formative. There are lots of ways you can approach his thought, different angles of approach. Music's a big one. The music's so important to him. But the event I'd like to emphasize is that during the early part of World War I, Marcel is medically disqualified or medically released from military service, but he definitely wants to be part of the war effort. And he becomes the head of this Red Cross Information Service in Paris. And the job of this service is to try to find out what's going on with soldiers missing in action, missing at the front. So these family members, fiancés, come into the service and they haven't heard anything from their loved one that's in these huge battles of the early part of the war with massive casualties. Mm-hmm. And there's many missing in action, as you might expect in the chaos of all that. So Marcel becomes very good at sort of knowing where the different units are and writing people in the units to get more information on these missing soldiers. He creates what he calls a catalog of the mind to do this. But that part of his job is the one that he can sort of just go into his office and work on. Mm-hmm. But then he has to tell these inquirers that their loved one often has been killed. So he has to go out and meet that mother and father face to face and talk to them. Mm-hmm. And I think that this has a huge influence on Marcel in many, many ways. For one thing, he's a lifelong critic of the dangers of bureaucracy and of a technocratic approach to life. Mm-hmm. And I think this event with World War I shapes him in a couple ways. One is he knows that it can work if it's set up correctly on its own terms. Mm-hmm. He becomes very good at finding the location or the whereabouts or the fate of these missing soldiers. Mm-hmm. So he can create sort of a formula. Well, they were in this unit, so I'm going to write this person. If that doesn't work, I'm going to work this person. And he's very good at solving that problem. So that kind of bureaucracy often doesn't work very well, but sometimes it can. Sometimes that kind of approach can work very well. So it's probably not going anywhere, Marcel realizes. In fact, it's probably going to expand greatly and be augmented with technology over the course of the 20th century, which of course it has been to an unbelievable degree in the 21st century. But the big danger of that, he sees, is just reducing that missing soldier to a case, to a number, to a factor in equation. So there's something inherently reductive about this way of approaching things. It reduces someone to an index card, he would say. And he saw the temptation of that whenever he went to talk to those parents, because he could just play the part of a bureaucrat and reserve bureaucrats. Like, well, sorry to tell you, but here's what I found. Goodbye. Right? Mm-hmm. He could not really engage with them as humans. He could just say, I had this job to do and I did it. Problem solved. But the thing is, the problem isn't solved for the parents, right? Maybe it brings a bit of closure, but he was very socially aware, very sensitive, and he saw that for the parents, this was going to be a lifelong process of dealing with the loss of their son, of their fiance. This is not something that's solved by determining that they were killed. Mm-hmm. And so this distinction between problem and mystery becomes very important to him. A problem is something you can solve with a generalizable formula, right? A mathematical equation is a great sense of a problem. Trying to replace, I don't know, the filter on your automobile, the oil filter on your automobile. That's something anyone can do if they're explained the process, and it works in every instance for a given make and model. The 20th century, modernity, we might say, is very good at solving problems. Mm-hmm. But it's losing its sense to deal with what Marcel calls mystery. A mystery is something in which you are involved. You're not just sort of standing apart from it and solving it. You're involved in it. It has a grip on you. It has its roots in you. And there's a dimension of depth to it. There's layers and layers to a mystery. Mm. So the mystery of the death of a loved one is a key example for him, right? If you've lost a loved one, you might get good advice on how to navigate this, but it's not a problem that can be solved with a formula. It has to be worked out in its particulars. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a little different for each person. It depends on their relationship with the person that died. Mm-hmm. It depends on what else is going on in their life. And it's not going to be something that's done with in a finite set of time, like a solved problem. It's going to be something that they continue to live with and have to navigate. So Marcel was thinking that in modernity, we become better and better at solving problems, but we become less and less good at dealing with mystery. We're losing the language for it, which is very different than the language that we use for problem solving, right? Mm. And we also have this tendency to reduce problems to mysteries. Reduce mysteries to problems. Mm. So again, working in the information service, it would have been very easy for Marcel to just reduce that mystery of the lost loved one for the family to a problem that he thinks he solved by finding the whereabouts and the fate of the missing soldier. But he kept seeing, no, for these people, that's not what's going on. There's something more going on. Love is another big mystery for Marcel. And he says there's a real temptation in modernity to reduce love to libido, to will to power, to just these biological drives. But he says anyone that's actually in love is not going to be convinced by that. There's a lot more going on to that, and it feels much more personal in particular. So recovering that sense of mystery, that sense of the particularity of experience, but also the richness, the depth, the way you can never sort of fully get your mind around or extricate yourself from the experience of the death of a loved one or of something like love, that's a huge part of his philosophy. Mm. So instead of becoming just a bureaucrat, in those interactions with the family members, the grieving family members, what Marcel tried to do was to be truly present to them when they gave him that news. Mm. Not that he thought that he could necessarily make the situation better in that way, but he is honoring, trying to honor the their loss as a mystery that they're living out. He's not trying to sort of reduce it in some way. So that idea of being present to others, of being truly present to each other, that I think is another central idea for Marcel. In fact, I might say that's the main thing for him, is that ability for us to be present to each other, our failure to do it in most situations, and his sense that we're doing that less and less in modernity as we become more apt to deal in problems, as we become sort of more separated from each other by technology, as we become that, those are, I think that's his big problematic.
I mean, what springs to mind there is, it seems under the, speaking of car filters, under the hood, it seems temporal, seems actually to have a strange relationship with time, in the sense you mentioned, you know, problems, which modernity is full of problems to be solved, is the notion of a clear telos, teleology. If your car air filter is full and your car's overheating and stops, the teleology, the correct problem solving teleology would be to clear the air filter and to understand that teleology has been met, the car runs again smoothly and you can go on your way. But this notion of being present, well, the present is present, which sounds tautological, but to be present is to be in the present and doesn't have that relationship with the future. So the mystery seems to have a fairly intuitive relationship with the fact that there is, you know, this is all ongoing. This is ebb and flowing. It's developing. There is never going to be a point where you say, you know, your son has died, but don't worry. At this point in the future, this is how you solve the problem and everything will be, you know, it's always going to be there. And so does this seems to possibly be where the existentialism comes in, is that as human beings, we have to deal with the fact that like this doesn't stop, but we need to perhaps stop having this strange relationship with the future and, as you say, be present. But this whole notion of being present has once again also been pulled in recent years largely from an oversimplification of Buddhist ideas into a very westernized idea of like just be in the now and everything will be fine, which, you know, that's also become kind of ruined. So as you say that to be present with the other is possibly the central idea. I mean, just to expand on that, what is that? What is it to be that? And I guess what is it to be that existentially as well?
Yeah, just to comment briefly on what you just said, I think that's spot on. So for Marcel, he would say that yeah, you need to be in the moment, but you also have to have this sense of openness towards the future, right? You can't sort of figure out everything ahead of time, and you need to be okay with that. In fact, something like hope for Marcel, which is another one of his major themes, is very much bound up with that idea. It's not for Marcel hope for particular outcomes. It's instead this sense that the story's ongoing, that there's still possibility there, that the future isn't determined. There's more to it than that, but that's an important element of it that I think resonates with what you just said. Mm-hmm. So coming back to that, what does it mean to be present to others? Marcel would say that based on experience, perhaps everyone knows the difference between someone who's present to them and someone who isn't in, say, a conversation or a relationship. And he'll even say that it's not exactly the same as attention, which is certainly a related thing. And certainly presence would involve attention. You need to be attentive to a person to be present. I think he would agree with that. But you can imagine something like a dentist who's very attentive to what's going on, but isn't really present to you, right?
But that's a problem, right?
He's solving. That's right. They're dealing in problems, right? So you can be very attentive to a problem, but not be truly present to the person that's involved, qua person. So, you know, you think about your best conversations with other people. They usually involve presence. You feel like you're being listened to. You feel like there's reciprocity. you feel like there's openness on the other person's part. You don't even have to agree with each other. It's not necessarily a matter of that. It's more of a matter of this person is fully here and is approaching me as a person and is open to me. And of course, to be at its fullest, it sort of needs that to go both ways.
I think there's a question there in relation to the bureaucracy and the technology with respect to that, with respect to this reciprocal nature. I mean, this is something that's come up, you know, in relation to modernity many times on the podcast to the point where it's become a cliche. It's very much a reality in the UK. I'm not so sure about America, but this notion of, you know, you go into a shop, you put your items on the counter, you say, hey, how are you? Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. How are you? Yeah, I'm fine. I would argue that neither of those people are actually there at all. So with regard to experience, there's no reciprocal. That is almost a bureaucratic. We're solving a problem. We basically aren't human at that point. We're solving the problem of shopping, even though the possibility of being present is there. So when we retreat back to this kind of machinic, technocratic, bureaucratical thing that we've fallen into, where are we? What is that experience?
Yes. I think Marcel would agree with you. Of course, it could be worse. You know, you could be outright rude to the clerk. But yeah, there's something just sort of hollow and mechanical mm-hmm. about that interaction. So Bergson's a big influence on Marcel. I think in particular in the dangers of being mechanical, habituated, that's always bad for Marcel, right? Mm-hmm. You want to be responsive. You want to be there. You want to be open to what's going on around you. And that means you're going to adjust to what's going on around you. So in that interaction you just described, that's a pretty mechanical interaction. Mm-hmm. So lots of things. Marcel often uses this image of secreting a shell, like the ego secretes a shell over you. And you exist within your own sort of thoughts, within your own projects. Pride's often the source of this, but it wouldn't have to be, right? You can rightly recoil from people treating you poorly and put up that shell, right? And that's a very different sort of thing, maybe more understandable. But also just falling into a routine kind of puts up this shell around you, according to Marcel. And for Marcel, the goal is always to either break out of that shell or have that shell broken through. Because sometimes you encounter that person that's present and they call you out of it, right? Maybe you go in for that mechanical interaction with the clerk and this clerk's just super present and engages you in a real conversation and gives you this tremendous gift that way, because they've drawn you out of your habituated approach and given you the gift of their presence, but also pulled you out so that you're present as well. And that's going to have an effect on the rest of your day too. So yeah, you need to break through that shell, Marcel would say, in which we're all enclosed so that we're cut off from other people. You know, not literally cut off. You're still handing money to the clerk. You're still, you know, stepping around people on the sidewalk. But there's a way in which you're closed off from all of that. And, you know, it's very easy for us to fall into this. This is, I think, one of the great challenges in my own life, is that I kind of yearn for that to be present. And I think I have my times when I'm really good at it, but more often than not, I'm not very good at it. And I think that's true of a lot of people. Maybe it's particularly true of me. I don't know. Phones certainly make that worse. Cell phones, smartphones. But yeah, I think all the life happens in the times that you're present. And doesn't necessarily only have to be to people, right? It can be to the natural world. It can be to the text you're reading, the painting that you're looking at. There are all these different varieties of being present and encountering presence that are important to Marcel. But one thing that our conversation is bringing out is that there's kind of a doubleness at play here. Being present to others is kind of has an ethical dimension, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. If we're present to them, we're going to be responsive. We're going to respect their personhood more. Mm-hmm. We're going to probably help them if they need help. We're going to be more likely to say the right thing or not say anything at all. There's all these ways in which we're going to honor the other better when we're present. And in fact, presence would be the precondition to that for Marcel. In a way, maybe it's putting it too strongly, but I think he would agree that being present is the departure point for being ethical.
Mm.
In that way, Iris Murdoch's another person that he influences. And I think there's a lot going into her statement that attention is at the heart of ethics. But I think that Marcel is part of what's going into that for her. He has this other word that gets at being present to others. My French isn't very good, but disponibilité. So sometimes that's translated in English as disposability in the sense of being at the disposal of someone else. But that's a pretty horrible translation in terms of English connotation, because it sounds like you're throwing something in the trash or throwing somebody in the trash, which isn't what he's getting at all. Sometimes it's translated as availability, being available to others. I think that's a better translation. But what it loses, at least in my reading, is this sense of alert readiness, of responsiveness, this dynamism that I think's there for Marcel. Mm-hmm. You know, I could go too far. You don't want to be overeager in your presence, in your receptivity to others, in your availability to others. But for him, it's kind of this creative dynamic state. And again, I think that Bergson influence, it's not just a habituated thing. It's a thing that has energy, that has life, to be present for someone, to be available. So like I was saying, there's this ethical dimension of it, but also he thinks that when you're present, you're kind of opening yourself. Go back to that image of being enclosed in a shell. That shell opens it up, and that's where you actually contact being, right? Mm. Being in its richness and fullness. And whenever Marcel uses the word being, I think that's usually what he means, is this experience of a depth of being, a richness of being. Mm. And you don't have that when you're all closed in on yourself. So there's almost this kind of circle that's going on for Marcel. If you open yourself to others, you better attend to them. So there's this ethical stance you're achieving. But then you get this return gift of a fullness of life, a fullness of being.
Hmm. To draw in the Catholic angle, it seems there that to draw those threads together, it seems that the modern world then, with all its problems to be solved, is oddly highly eschatological, but it's completely failed. So there is an eschatology of the so-called secular atheistic modern world. I mean, there is an eschatology in the end times of even that car filter. You know, the car runs again, we're complete. But it's not a true, it's almost not a true one, doesn't fulfill anything for the long term. And so in this notion of being present, there's a reasoning which is not of this world, which then therein gives one a reason to live more fully in this world, if this makes sense. So, you know, of course, with Christianity, it's the notion that the afterlife is to come, the world is to come. There is a reason, there is a teachings and reasonings as to act a certain way towards man, and that's a reason to live now. Live more fully and be more present now for others, a sort of a foundation as to why one would act the way they do. But the modern world doesn't have this, and so it seems to be actually constantly clawing at something, which is, you know, the next problem, the next problem, the next problem. And what it seems to not have there is the other word you mentioned, which also, I mean, this is something I think is central to Chiron but rarely mentioned, is that the modern world doesn't have any hope. Because there's nothing to hope for, like for Christians. I mean, hope is a key value. It's a key facet of what it is to be a Christian, is to have that hope for many different things. But once that's gone away, I think you scramble towards problems because they at least give you something to do. But there's no actual they fill a hole for a while, for a very very brief moment while you're playing around with the car filter, as in your example, but they don't fulfill. And I think hope probably is the factor there. There's nothing greater. There's nothing deeper. To bring in a title of your other book and another key aspect for Marcel, there's no wonder in the world of problems. You don't wonder about problems. There's no mystery to the, as we're saying, there's no mystery to the car filter. Sorry,
lot in there. Lot in there that I think is all spot on, and there's so much we could do with it. So on that notion of wonder, he explicitly says that there's this atrophy of wonder that he worries about in the world that's been reduced to the problematic. And he ties that wonder to what he feels like is a deep human ontological need. We have this need for being in its richness. We have this need to connect with the world, with others. But that kind of becomes debased and becomes lesser as we deal more and more exclusively in problems. So obviously we're going to still feel this sense that something's missing, but the sharper sense that might be brought by a sense of wonder, which kind of points in the right direction, that might be dulled. So he finds that he worries that a lot of moderns are in this low-grade depressed state. They feel like something's missing, but they're not getting the strong cue that an experience of wonder would provide, that what you need is to open yourself up to this, because they've been so dulled down and sort of run down by dealing in this problematic world and of thinking of themselves as a set of problems and functions. So reducing their own person to tasks they can do or roles that they hold, and losing track of being creative creatures, of being creatures that are naturally given to wonder and naturally given to asking, why am I here? Those kind of questions. We lose the language for those. We maybe even lose the sense that we should be asking those kind of questions in an increasingly problematic world. Now, Marcel would also say that certainly problem solving is important, and dealing with problems has always been a part of human history, though often it's kind of sacralized. I think in most traditional cultures, there's not that clear distinction between solving problems, something that's a problem, something that's has a greater significance. And even our example that, you know, I might have gotten us down the wrong track with the car examples, because I think Marcel would say at least that draws you into your body, at least draws you into contact with physical things and with the world. And there's definitely something important to that. Marcel's a big thinker of embodiment. And it's probably going to be less likely that you land in just a world of the problematic if you're doing your own handiwork. In fact, that might be part of the solution now. But if you're just sort of sorting papers all day or clicking and sort of just living in this truly abstract domain, that's where the problematic becomes really problematic for Marcel.
Embodiment then. Just expand upon embodiment. I'm always keen on philosophers who emphasize the body, because so very few do. Most philosophers like to stay in that abstract realm.
Yeah, and one of the ways that Marcel influences existentialism is that along with Jean Val, he says we need to begin in the concrete situation and in the concrete web of relations that come from that, the context that become of that. And that calls thought back to the body as well. And if you think about being present, so much of that is communicated, as Marcel says in passing, though he could have meditated on this more, with eye contact, with posture, with like what you just did right there, where you sort of hummed in agreement and nodded to show you're tracking. Being present is an embodied phenomenon. A really interesting question is whether there's something lost, and I think there is, in an interaction like this, even though, you know, I really enjoy it. You know, if we were across the table from each other in person, I think there would be a heightened presence and there would be a different sort of qualitative dynamic. So Marcel is very attentive to those. And he would be very annoyed that I haven't said more about his work as a playwright. But I think that for him, he saw his plays as the origin point of his philosophies. So he was quick to say, okay, my plays don't just take my philosophical ideas and dramatize them. Instead, my philosophical works are reflections on what I sort of first discover through writing these plays. And you can see this in his philosophical works, and it annoys some people. I get it. He'll have these long extracts from his plays that he then comments upon in his works. But if you think about plays are very much about presence, the presence of the actor, the dynamics between the actor and audience, but also a good actor isn't just reciting lines rote. They're kind of embodying them, and they're creating these complex dynamics of presence and absence between characters. So I think that he thought that drama, art in general, could often call us back to that concrete situation, which is paradoxically also calling us back to the richness of existence. And it's especially important for philosophy, because at least modern philosophy, he thinks, has a tendency to tend towards the abstract, the generalizable, the concept, rather than those richness and particulars of experience.
Is that getting worse, that abstraction? It seems to have connection to the ever-increasing technological world.
Yeah. I can't help but be pretty pessimistic as I use my devices too much myself. You know, I am not self-righteous in this. I'll be the first to say how much I struggle with these things. I'm not as pessimistic as I once was, because I do feel like I've made lots of good and real friendships over these platforms. But you have to cut against their biases to do that. So I think Marcel would say it is, in a way, getting worse, or at least there are many ways in which, more than any other time in human history, one can fully retract from presence. I think you can have all your groceries delivered. You can basically live in a bubble and spend all your time online. And I think there is something important lost by that. I don't think that every person that lives that way becomes a fanatic or goes crazy, but I think everyone loses something when they do that. I know that I can count my own loss, feel my own losses in that regard. When I think about how much time I spend just wasting it on this addiction machine in my pocket, rather than being with families, loved ones,
or just being.
Going out and being in the nature, and just being, yeah, just chilling out. I think one of the worst things is how we just automatically reach into our pockets when there's any downtime. You know, if you were waiting at a bus station 20 years ago, you might pull out a book or a newspaper and read it, or you might stick on your headphones, but you're also much more apt to just sort of look around and to be and to notice. Matthew Crawford, who's great, might be someone to invite on the show at some point. He wrote Shop Class of Soulcraft, so he would definitely have been bristling against my car filter example earlier, because he too thinks that a big part of the answer is doing more stuff with our hands. But then he has this book, The World Beyond Your Head, I think it's called. And one of the things he describes there is exactly that loss of what he calls the eros of just walking around town and being sort of drawn here and drawn there and sort of, you know, having this responsive relationship to your surroundings. I do think that that's endangered. But Marcel would also say, and here's why I'm not a determinist, he would also say, you know, I can put away my phone. In some ways, many of us live materially a much, I don't want to downgrade the people that have real material needs, but we live in pretty affluent societies if we live in the United States or the UK. So for many of us, we could be much more present. That's a perennial option. It's just a matter of how to overcome those biases, overcome those habituated recourses to always be mediated by screens, I guess, now.
Revealed preference would say that there's a reason, you know, there's a reason why we go one way and not the other. Do you think there's, maybe for Marcel as well, do you think there's an avoidance, something that, you know, you step towards presence, you go, oh, I don't really like that, you know? There's something there that we don't want to engage with.
Yeah. So it's hard. It's demanding, I think, to be truly present. And I think Marcel would say that you were talking about ebbs and flows earlier. I think that's spot on. I think Marcel would say we're always going to be ebbing and flowing. And probably there's going to be times where we just need to. Well, he would certainly say that there's a difference between withdrawing from others because you're putting up a carapace or a shell, and really recollecting yourself in solitude. That's important. So Marcel would say that the saints and sanctity are great examples of this. I think what most interests him about many saints is their ability to be present to others. But also, saints model that back and forth where you're withdrawing into presence of God in solitude or in prayer. And that's in a way energizing you to engage with others. So there's a kind of solitude that isn't self-enclosed, that's kind of renewing. And you're still getting in touch with being, according to Marcel, in something like that. And he would also say he loved to go hiking in the mountains. He would say that for many people, being in the natural world can be that source of open, rejuvenating solitude / presence, paradoxically present. But yeah, it's really tough to be present all the time. And the thing I think that he doesn't give enough credence to in his philosophical writings, but does so more in his plays, is that often we're recoiling from people being manipulative or abusive or generally awful. There are lots of good reasons to put up a shell for many, many people. You know, Marcel would say, we live in a broken world. That's one of his favorite phrases. So he recognizes it. But I think in his plays, he sees more, he gives us more examples of that kind of dynamic. But he also shows us characters that realize that they still have to risk openness at some point if they want to lead a fulfilled life, right? So he has this feud. And if you know anything else about Marcel, not you, but sort of listeners, beyond that he's an existentialist, it'd probably be that he has this feud with Sartre. So they're kind of frenemies, I think you might say. So Marcel would agree with Sartre about a lot of the dynamics of bad faith and manipulation and allowing yourself to take on these roles that you haven't really chosen and that kind of limit or corrupt you, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But for Marcel, the great danger for someone like Sartre is that he sort of sees bad faith everywhere. And Marcel thinks that the solution to bad relationships is good relationships. And that humans are necessarily relational.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, to relate that back to Sartre, though, it's sort of a quip, but a lot of people often, you know, Sartre in popular culture is often people quote, you know, hell is other people, right?
Yeah.
And I can't remember who some other guest on the show said, yeah, hell is other people if you hang out with nihilistic philosophers like Sartre all day, then yeah, it's going to be where you're shutting down. Like if you say that, then you're shutting down the conversation. So hell is other people. If you're sat around in a cafe chain smoking and talking about how there's no meaning all day, then sure, it probably is. But there seems to be a shutting down of what we were talking about earlier of the reciprocal relationship of what it is to be someone with someone else. You know, but I guess, you know, the differences are certainly deeper, but I certainly align more with Marcel, with hope.
Yeah, I think I do too. I mean, I think that Sartre is a great diagnostician of how things can go wrong, but I don't think he gives us much, at least in being in nothingness. I don't think he gives us much good advice about what we should do instead. I think I'm much closer to Marcel for sure. You know, and Marcel, this is kind of fun. Marcel could be prickly, and he loved a good debate, and he loved some good intellectual fisticuffs. And so I do think there is, in my sense of it, is that there's kind of a performative aspect in way to his feud with Sartre. Mm. I think there's some real parts to it, but I think it's just part of their dynamic. And there are also examples of each helping the other in various ways. And there's definitely an appreciation and a respect alongside the criticisms. But my favorite burn that Marcel gives Sartre is that in one of his books, he says, you know, Sartre's just an Orestes with kind of parent problems, just sulking around. And I'm Perseus out here trying to slay the Gorgon of despair. and I think that's just... Some great philosophical smack talk right there.
I would agree. I mean, you mentioned being in nothingness. I mean, it's probably, I think it's the only time it's been mentioned on the podcast. But it reminds me of the Dreyfus, the Heidegger scholar, said, yeah, being in nothingness is the most intelligent misreading of Heidegger there is, which I think is a real sly comment about Sartre. Yeah. there's just a, such a difference in temperament, it seems, between Marcel and Sartre, though, that... yeah, I mean, I think the thing there that's gone is wonder. I mean, there's sort of an acceptance on the side of Sartre to that wonder's gone, which I don't think is entirely true. And this question of, you know, this reality in the modern world of not really questioning, you know, it sounds like pretentious for a lot of Westerners, but some days you have those moments of like pure, you know, call them pure attention, if you like, of yourself, because you've been so carried away with whatever problem it is, or you're in abstraction. You know, sometimes I look at my hands and I'm like, I'm real, right? It sounds so pretentious, right? But the wonder of like, is this not, you know, kind of almost not horrifying, like positively, like wondrously horrifying, if that makes any sense. But like, you look yourself in the mirror and there's wonder there, because you exist, you're a being that has consciousness, you are a consciousness of experience. And Sartre, I think, seems to have gone the other way of like, let's just shut that down and, you know, get rid of that whole facet of what it is to be human. I think, you know, he almost ties up existentialism a bit too quickly, that it's necessarily a negative thing, possibly.
And that's a big reason why Marcel wanted to separate himself from the term, is that sense that it's very negative and atheistic. You know, there are several reasons why he wants to separate himself from Sartre's existentialism. And there's probably, on Marcel's part, some frustration that Sartre has become such a big deal. Yeah, I think, to come back to your comment, one other thing I might say is that, at least in a lot of places in Sartre, there's this horror or nausea at the thingness of the world and our entanglement with things and with others. And Marcel definitely views our interdependence and our openness and our connection to things not only as just a fact of existence. So therefore, if you're automatically nauseous at that, you're in trouble, because that's just the way things are. But also, the only way that you encounter being and its richness again for Marcel is to open yourself up to relations. So that's another, I think, difference.
If you already shut down those relations, if you already have that nausea, as you say, then those relations are going to be nothing else. And also from that, it's almost that, I don't want to say Gnostic, but almost like a strangely, maybe even Neoplatonic, like atheistic Neoplatonic hatred of the body, you know, that I don't think you'd necessarily see in, you see in some strands of Christianity, but I think Catholicism, you don't see it as much, this sort of loathing of being in a body or having to exist in that form isn't necessarily there. So I guess a couple of questions would be, Where do we see Marcel's influence now? Because as you say, you know, one thing the list of thinkers that's commonly tackled on this podcast are these like Weil was one, you've mentioned Bergson, who in their day were extremely popular, were the talk of the town, and seem to have, unless you really dig deep, but you normally don't have to dig that deep. Normally these people are influences for the names that we know, and they all refer back to them. Weil is one, Bergson is one. But they themselves have disappeared. So where do we see Marcel's influence now?
Yeah, so there's a lot of trickle-down influence, because he was so darn influential on other thinkers. Mm. So along with Martin Buber, who's a very much a kindred spirit, he's a big influence on Levinas. Mm. He's a big influence on Paul Ricoeur, who's another one of his students. He's a big influence in America in fiction and sort of philosopher writers like Walker Percy and Flannery O'Connor. Mm-hmm. He's a big influence on Iris Murdoch, who's having somewhat of a renaissance, I think justly so, at the moment. So there are figures that he's influenced that I think are getting a lot of attention right now. Mm-hmm. So in that way, he's still present through that influence. But you've mentioned on the show before how there are some thinkers who have this tremendous influence, but it's almost like they disappear behind the people that they influence. Mm. I think for a while, Husserl was kind of like that. You know, Heidegger kind of displaced him. And now you go back to Husserl and find, oh, Heidegger didn't sort of fix up his old teacher. There's a lot here that's that's really rich or intention, and that he may have had the better point than Heidegger on this and that. So Marcel's one of those thinkers, I think, that's kind of happened to. It's kind of this idea that, oh, yeah, there's Levinas, and maybe there's Martin Buber, and there's Marcel. He's doing some of the same things. He's important. But, you know, if you've read these other figures, you probably got it all. And those figures are awesome and should be read. But Marcel has a lot of his own particular contributions, I think, to make. There are philosophers today that are influenced by him, but I do think that he's not been the same kind of influence as a lot of the sort of first tier canonical thinkers of the 20th century. So William Desmond, who I wrote a book about, the contemporary Irish philosopher, I would say he's one of the most original grapplers with the big questions today in philosophy. Mm-hmm. And Marcel's an important influence on him. It was working on Desmond in part that brought me to Marcel. Actually, a couple of my colleagues in the philosophy department here at BMI recommended Marcel first, and I tried to read it and found it pretty, I just wasn't resonating with it. Mm. And then I saw that he was influenced on Marcel, who did influenced on Desmond, who did resonate with me. I was like, oh no, now I've got to go back and really read Marcel. And then I fell in love with him. So Desmond carries on Marcel's influence. Brendan Sweetman, who edits the Marcel Studies Journal and in the Marcel, is, I think, president of the Marcel Society, which is a great thing if you're interested in Marcel, to check out their website. Lots of good stuff there. But he's also a very formidable and important philosopher in his own right. So he's drawing on Marcel to do constructive work. There are young philosophers like Terence Sweeney and Paul Camacho, who are Desmond students, that are doing good things with Marcel, I think. Probably the most hopeful thing is that a lot more of his books are coming back into print. Mm-hmm. So St. Augustine's Press has brought a lot of his plays and The Mystery of Being, that two-volume book that a lot of people see as his big sort of masterwork. They brought that back into print. Fordham University brought Creative Fidelity, which is my favorite of his books, back into print. Cluny Press, who's bringing out a lot of Catholic works of the early 20th century, doing tremendous work and really nice editions. They're bringing back out a lot of Marcel's books. So I think that one of the best ways to encourage more attention to a thinker is to have those texts available. Mm-hmm. There are still others that I wish were available. So The Decline of Wisdom, which is this little book of social and political thought, you can get that on Internet Archive for free with an account, but it's not in print. I wish it would be. But so there are lots of ways that you can see Marcel in the undercurrents of thought, but he's not at the forefront the way I think that he deserves to be.
Is there anything you'd like to add about Marcel and his work?
Yeah, so one more thing I might mention is that we talked about the importance of the death of his mother. We talked about the importance of those encounters with the grieving inquirers at the Red Cross Information Center during World War I. I think that Marcel, one of the big differences that he underscored between himself and Heidegger, and this is something that Levinas does as well, is that for Marcel, it's the death of the other that's more devastating than one's own death. Mm-hmm. And against the claim that heaven is kind of a selfish idea, he says, well, often people that are hope for heaven are hoping for their lost loved ones to be there, hoping for their sake. So that the other, that sort of underscores how important the other is for Marcel. But also, you said a couple of episodes ago, I think it was with John Michael Greer, that it's not so much that people are scared of death, is that they've kind of forgotten it or blocked it out. Am I getting you right on that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's a non-entity. It's something that's avoided until it can't be. And then you're left with a big mess. But I don't think, you know, a lot of modern people would say that I'm probably very, very, sound very nihilistic or pessimistic on this. But I think at a certain point, one realizes that a lot of one's life, if spent maturely, is really preparation for death, which sounds absurd. Like people, you know, a lot of modern people would say, why would you spend all your time alive thinking about death? And that comes at death from the notion that it's a hard stop, that it's no more life. And of course, if you move away from that, then it's a different thing. You know, it's just, once again, to go back to Marcel's term, terms, ebbs and flows, right? I mean, if you're if you're of a Christian religion, it's going to be a hard stop. But many other religions, it's going to keep going. But there is a continuation. And so it's not so much, not talking about it. It's more of an unconscious ignorance. That's why I would say it's that problem with the hard stops is it's seen as anathema to life as opposed to something that is always absolutely intermingled with it. And to avoid that, you avoid a huge aspect of what life is. If you treat it as like black and white, like white life is good. I have to live. I have to go on a cruise. I have to blah, blah, blah. I have to like live to the fullest vitally. And that death is black and negative. And so don't ever touch on it. It's like, yeah, it's just, you know, there is night and day. There is pain and there is pleasure, right? And you have to have both. And we seem to want to deny one side, which I personally think actually means you're not living. Like you have one side of life in that way. I've repeated myself a lot there, but yeah.
I think Marcel would agree with that. And one of the reasons I brought that up is that when you made that comment on the other episode, I thought, oh yeah, that's a comment that Marcel would really nod his head to. I think he would say that it's part of that reducing a mystery to a problem. Mm-hmm. Your own death, the death of loved ones, the death of anyone is a mystery that they have to navigate. And those around them have to navigate. But we want to treat it just as that kind of biological endpoint. And often we're very good at sort of pushing it to the margins, you know, displacing it onto retirement homes, things like that, so we don't have to think of it as more than that. You know, there is that blocking it out. And Marcel would say that one of the big consequences of this, and this is what I wanted to, I think, underscore, is the failure to know how to be present to the dying, right? To accompany someone through death. I think Marcel thinks we're getting very bad at that. And, you know, I don't want to go much into the details, but I think I was, for as much as I study these things and try to live them out, and do think I have my successes. You know, my own family, I had an experience with this, with a dying loved one, that I was just struck by how ill-equipped I was for this, right? And how strong the temptation was to just withdraw. So, I mean, I think that Marcel is probably right about that tendency and that sort of shortcoming. Not that it's ever been easy to accompany a loved one through death, but and I think that one of the things that he thinks is important about that is you'll come out the other side transformed. This is something he shows in his plays too. That there, as painful as it is, it's also potentially humanizing and like few other things in a very, very profound way.
Well, I think as well that connects, you know, I think of the one time that I've also had to deal with like a family member dying and going to see them in hospital. And I was one of the last actually to see them, someone I was very close to. One thing that if you'd had a sort of embodied closeness, even if in the years leading up to it, wouldn't have been so difficult, is that you are suddenly confronted with the fact that you, like the embodiment of the other, because of their dying, is sort of handed over to you. And if you did, you could avoid it. You could say, nurse, come in. You know, I mean, it wasn't anything gruesome or anything like that, but I don't know, you might have to wipe drool, or you might have to like even hold the hand, right? It's someone that you're close with and you always talk to in abstraction, but now suddenly they're scared, or they're in a coma and you want to say goodbye and you think you want to hold their hand. All of a sudden you're confronted with like, I have to deal with this human body. And it's like this, and if you don't, well, it's going to be almost like, I think of Blanchot, the what you spoke about with notion of avoiding death. Blanchot has this notion of having a proper death. And I feel like you'd almost, if you push death away, and if you push death away for others and take all the tablets and do all this, you're avoiding having that sort of, I don't want to say noble as if it's romantic, but you're avoiding having that, like, okay, you know, I've had my time, proper death, as Blanchot would call it. And I think of dogs more often than not about proper death. Like, dogs know their time, they go find a spot that they loved, and they sit down, and they usually go to sleep, and you go find them late, and you go, huh, they died under their favorite tree, how nice. Whereas human beings, oh God, you know, give me the pills, plug me into the machine. Yeah. So, you know, that notion of a proth of death, I think, comes with a lot of embodiment. And yeah, if we were just more open to it, it wouldn't be as ghastly. But I don't think we're close to that yet. We're still on the avoidance side of things, trying to live forever.
Yeah. And the other thing that Marcel would add is that, and this is where part of his religious interest came very early on, is that Marcel thought you could remain kind of present and available to those that have passed on. And you can sort of sense their presence that way, right? And they can still be sort of a presence in your life. And he thought it was very hard to pin down what's going on there. Right. Mm-hmm. But he thought that that's a real experience. And he resisted the idea that it's just something that's coming from you. He said, if you're truly open, he felt like it was coming. He felt like he had some sort of sentiment of the beyond, of the lost loved one, mm-hmm. in that experience of presence. And that's probably one of his more controversial views, for sure. But, he thought lots of people have that experience, not everyone, but lots. And he thought, you know, something that should be taken seriously. I think he'd had that experience very strongly, even for his mom, who he lost so young. And I think that's a big thing for him.
Where would you advise people to begin with Marcel?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So Brendan Sweetman has a Gabriel Marcel reader from St. Augustine's Press. That's a good place to start. I think that this book, The Philosophy of Existentialism, mm-hmm. has an essay at the beginning called On the Ontological Mystery. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty great place to start. That's one of the very unsystematic thinker. Didn't want to be systematic. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to be put in a box, always on the move. But that's one of the essays where he really lays out the major themes of his work and makes it a good entry point. I really like the volume Creative Fidelity. Mm-hmm. That's actually the first one that I read, and I got a lot out of it. So that's another entry point. There's a book, I think it's called The Philosophical Background of Human Dignity, and mm-hmm. I think that Clooney just brought it out. And that's based on essays that he gave, I mean, lectures that he gave, I think, in 1961 and 62, towards the end of his life in the United States. And that's also a great entry point because it weaves together autobiography and his plays and his developing philosophical thought and kind of works chronologically in a way through his journey. So that's also a pretty accessible starting point and very holistic. And if you're interested in how American thinkers like William James and Hawking and Royce influenced Marcel, that's good too, because I think he takes coming back to America as a place to give a nod to these American influences on his thought.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good place to finish up. I'll be sure to put the links for our previous discussion on your book on William Desmond in the description below. What are you working on now?
Yeah, so right now I had a book come out recently called A Heart of Flesh, William Desmond and the Bible, mm-hmm. that I edited, and that just came out recently from Cascade Press. Has a lot of great essays by a variety of Desmond scholars that are looking at Desmond's readings of the Bible or ways we can use Desmond's thought to approach the Bible. And right now I'm wrapping up a co-authored critical introduction of the contemporary German-Korean philosopher Byung-Chul Han, who's really interesting on these questions of how technology affects presence. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a theme that runs through my writings and my interests on these concerns. I'm drawn to thinkers that are grappling with them. So that will come out in the summer from Polity. And I co-wrote that with Rob Wiley, who's a political philosopher, and Ethan Stoneman, who's kind of a media theorist, rhetorician. And my contributions to that volume focus on Hans' aesthetics mm-hmm. and his focus on contemplation. So that's coming out soon too. And beyond that, just looking forward to maybe doing some more reading and writing some more occasional essays, and see what comes up.
Well, that all sounds great. I think that's a good place to finish up. Steve Knepper, thanks once again.
Thank you, James.